So I'm going to discuss indeed instabilities of trapped excited Bose-Einstein condensates. So this work has been done at the École Normale with Jean Dalibard, Ralph Doom and Alice Sinatra. Ralph and Alice are two postdocs. And also we have a collaboration with Peter Fedichev and Jura Shlepnikov, with Maxim Olshany, who is in the audience, and with Klaus Mulmer. So what are the physical motivations of this work? Well, the idea is to try to test the validity of the Gross-Pitevsky equations in time-dependent situations. We know already that the Gross-Pitevsky equation has been tested successfully in thermodynamical equilibrium situations, at least at temperatures less than Tc, and also it has been tested close to equilibrium. When you slightly excite a condensate, you can calculate the response of the condensate, so the frequency of the collective excitations. And as discussed by Stringari yesterday, you get an excellent agreement with the experiments. So then the idea is to consider different situations, situation where the condensate is strongly excited in the trap. So you are very far from the thermal equilibrium situation. And we know in this case that you can get a dramatic effect if you strongly drive the condensate. For example, you could imagine this experiment that you change the trap frequency abruptly from a large value to a very small value. Then the condensate will start oscillating in this trap, and eventually it will stabilize. But now, if this frequency omega at time t equals 0 plus is very, very small, then the gas will be very dilute at thermal equilibrium. So that basically the temperature at t equals plus infinity will be equal to the initial energy per particle in the trap, which is roughly on the order of the chemical potential. And now you can arrange that this mu is large enough so that this finite temperature is actually larger than the critical temperature and there is no condensate at the end. So the process of oscillation of the condensate will lead at some stage to a destruction of the condensate, and you would like to understand the early stages of this destruction. So the outline of my talk is the following. First, I will describe the general strategy we're going to use to attack this problem. In the second part, I will discuss the linear stability of the solution of the Gross-Pitevsky equation in a harmonic trap when you are in the Thomas Fermi regime. You will see indeed from the first point that that's a relevant question you have to ask to determine the evolution of the condensate. And in the third point, I will try to make connection with the experiments in the case of a positive scattering length. In this talk, I'm not really interested by the phenomenon of collapse due to the negative scattering length. I'm more considering situations with a positive scattering length. So our general strategy was the following. We have to find a small parameter to get a systematic expansion of the equations of motion for the quantum field operator. And we've introduced as a small parameter the fraction of non-condensed particles. In fact, more precisely, it's a square root of the fraction of non-condensed particles. So initially, we assume that the temperature is very small and the condensate is at thermal equilibrium. So this fraction is indeed very small. Of course, when time proceeds, when you have strongly driven the condensate, you might destroy it. So this fraction of non-condensed particles is going to increase and might become large. So we know that this approach will fail in the long time limit. There is no hope of getting the behavior in the long time limit with this type of approach. But the advantage is that at least we have a systematic approach because we are going to expand the equations in terms of a small parameter. And I think this approach is more systematic than the usual mean-field approach that you use without rigorous justification. So here are the results of the expansion. At the zeroth order in the small parameter, all the particles are in the condensate, and we recover for the wave function of the condensate phi the time-dependent Gross-Pitevsky equation. So there is no surprise. To first order in the small parameter, we derive the linear dynamics of the non-condensed particles. Basically, we recover the Bogoliubov equations. And from this order, we can calculate the depletion of the condensate, simply by calculating the number of particles out of the condensate. And by going to the next order, we can derive the back action of the non-condensed fraction of particles on the condensate wave function, so we can derive the first correction to the Gross-Pitevsky equation. Okay, I mean, we'll give now a bit more details about the techniques of the calculation. So actually, we use a human symmetric approach. We don't break the symmetry. So we consider a system with a fixed number of particles, capital N. And as we assume that initially there's a state, so one particle state much more populated than the other states, then we split the field operator as psi is equal to phi fi plus delta psi. So this phi is phi exact is actually the exact condensate wave function. And this fi exact simply annihilates a particle in the state phi exact. And delta psi is a reminder. It acts on the states of the non-condensed particles. And the definition of phi exact is that it should be an eigenstate of the one-body density matrix. And this implies that this mean value of a phi exact dagger delta psi is exactly equal to zero. And in fact, we will use this equation in the perturbative treatment to derive order by order the equations for phi exact and for delta psi. So more specifically, to put this systematic expansion on a mathematical basis, we assume that the number of particles is going to infinity while the product n times the coupling constant between the particles remains a constant. So this coupling constant is to be proportional to the scattering length, so we assume that nA is fixed while n is going to infinity. In this case, one can show that the condensate wave function is converging to a finite, well-defined function phi. And then you can now expand phi exact in powers of 1 over square root of n. Because the fraction of non-condensed particles, actually, will scale as 1 over n. Well, if you want, the idea that this delta psi has matrix elements on the order of unity, whereas this a phi has matrix elements on the order of square root of n. So in this way, you find a small parameter as a ratio of 1 to a square root of n. So in principle, this phi exact has the first term scaling as phi 1 over square root of n. But in individual situations, you can show that this term is 0. And the first correction will be phi 2 over n. And we need also to have an operator to describe the dynamics of the non-condensed particles. And this operator is simply a phi exact dagger delta psi over square root of n. It annihilates a particle out of the condensate and puts it in the condensate. So I call this operator lambda exact. To zeroth order, I get lambda. Then I could calculate in principle a first order correction, lambda 1 over square root of n, and so on. So I'm going to give simply the results of the derivation. So to zeroth order, we get an equation for the condensate wave function phi, so the lowest order approximation for the condensate wave function phi, and we simply recover the Gross-Pitevsky equation with the kinetic energy term, the trapping potential, and the mean field interaction term. So to first order in the small parameter, we get the dynamics of the non-condensed particles. And you get that I h bar derivative of lambda, lambda dagger, is equal to some partial differential operator acting on lambda, lambda dagger. And this L is not exactly equal to the operator you get in the Bogoliubov equations, because here we don't break the symmetry, so there is a slight difference, there is a projector appearing among the matrix elements of L to ensure that actually, L, lambda, remains orthogonal to phi. Then when you go to next order, you get the first correction to the Gross-Pitevsky equation, giving the effect of the non-condensed particles on the condensate wave function. So this correction was phi 2 over n. And you have an equation like that, IH bar derivative of phi 2 over n, phi 2 star over n, is equal to the same partial differential operator appearing in the Bogoliubov type equations, acting on phi 2 over n, phi 2 star over n, plus a source term. So it's a non-homogeneous equation. And this source term is made of three lines, three contributions. The first one is proportional to delta n, the number of particles out of the condensate, which we can derive from lambda. Delta n is simply the integral of lambda dagger lambda over space. So this first line is very simple. It reveals the fact that there's a depletion of the condensate. So in fact, in the Gauss-Pilecki equation, it's better to replace n by n naught, the number of particles in the condensate. The second line describes the usual mean field effect of the non-condensed particles onto the condensed wave function. So you get two terms. The first one is a Hartree-Fock term, proportional to the local density in value of lambda dagger lambda of the non-condensed particles. And the second one involves the so-called anomalous average in value of lambda squared. So usually this anomalous average is neglected in what is called the Popov approximation. But I would say that there is no reason to neglect it in this approach. Actually, this systematic approach confirms that such a term exists in the corrected Gauss-Pilecki equation. And actually, I can give an example of a calculation performed by Maxime Olchany. So this is a calculation of the trap of the excitation, the frequency of the excited mode, the m equal to mode obtained in the Gila experiment, as function of the temperature measured in units of the critical temperature. So first, you have the experimental results, that are indicated by the points with error bars. Second, you have a solid line, which was derived by Maxime using the Hartree-Fock Bogoliubov approach, so therefore including the anomalous average. And then Maxime could redo the same calculation, but without including this anomalous average. And then you get this dotted line. And as you see, there's a good agreement between the solid line and the experimental results. And the agreement is less convincing when you remove the anomalous average. And actually, in this source term, we have a third line. We have, for the moment, no clear physical interpretation of this effect, of this line. But it is there, and it has to be included. So my conclusion would be that rather than removing the anomalous average in the Popov approximation, one has to add an extra term in the equation. Okay, so now I'm going to give a physical interpretation of this partial differential operator L, giving the Bogoliubov type equations. So consider a particular solution phi to the Gauss-Pilecki equation. And now consider a neighboring solution to this equation. This neighboring solution can be written as phi plus delta phi, where delta phi is very small. As delta phi is very small, I can linearize the Gauss-Pilecki equation around the specific solution phi. And then I get that IH bar derivative of delta phi star, is equal to some partial differential operator LGP acting on delta phi star. So if I'm interested now in the component of delta phi orthogonal to phi, it turns out that as phi plus delta phi is normalized, it's possible to eliminate the component of delta phi along phi and to get a closed equation for delta phi perp. So the component of delta phi orthogonal to phi. And you get this equation that IH bar derivative of delta phi perp star is equal to L acting on delta phi perp star. And this L, this operator, is exactly the one you get in the modified Bogoliubov equations. And it's not exactly surprising. As I said, the quantum fluctuations lambda have to be orthogonal to phi. because phi is an eigenstate of the one-body density matrix, so the states of the non-condensed particles are necessarily orthogonal to the condensate wave function. So that's why you get L by considering the evolution of a noise to phi, orthogonal to phi. Since we have now at hand this interpretation of the operator L, giving the evolution of lambda, lambda dagger, then we can simply predict the dynamics of the non-condensed particles from the linear stability analysis of the Gross-Pitevsky equation. And basically, there are two cases. In the first case, you find that phi is a stable solution of the Gross-Pitevsky equation, which means that the delta phi perp will grow at most polynomially with time. Typically, you find situations where the growth is linear with time. This means that the lambda operator will also grow linearly with time. And you are not going to get a fast depletion of the condensate. The number of non-condensed particles is going to grow polynomially with time. So the depletion of the condensate is slow, no dramatic effect. In the second case, you find that phi is an unstable solution of the Gross-Pitevsky equation. In this case, you can find small deviations from phi that are growing exponentially fast with time. And so will the operator lambda, and so will the number of non-condensed particles. In this case, the fast depletion of the condensate and the correlations to the Gross-Pitevsky equation might become important very soon. So first, it's possible to predict generally the existence of a linear divergence with time when you have a continuous family of periodic solutions to the Gross-Pitevsky equation. So I assume that I can find a continuous family of solutions of the Gross-Pitevsky equation such that they are periodic in time with a period tau depending on some control parameter gamma. So we have phi gamma of r at time t plus tau of gamma is equal to phi of gamma in r at time t. And now the idea is simply to differentiate this equation with respect to gamma. So when you differentiate the left-hand side, you get two contributions. The first one simply comes from the derivative of phi gamma with respect to the control parameter. It's this term. And the second contribution comes from the derivative of tau of gamma. And of course, the differentiation of the right-hand side gives simply the derivative of phi gamma with respect to gamma. And this equation is interesting because it relates d gamma of phi gamma at two different times, at t plus tau of gamma. And then you realize that this function is in general not a periodic function of time, because this expression is in general different from zero when 2 prime is different from zero. So now you see that if I consider a specific solution phi gamma of the Gross-Pitevsky equation, if I take as a neighboring solution phi of gamma plus delta gamma, where delta gamma is arbitrarily small, then the deviation delta phi between those two solutions will be proportional to the derivative of phi gamma with respect to gamma. And we have seen that this function is not a periodic function of time. And actually, using this expression, you can show that it diverges linearly with time with a coefficient proportional to 2 prime gamma over 2 gamma. So the conclusion is when you have a family of periodic solutions of the Gross-Pitevsky equation, and when the period depends on the control parameter, in a which is expected for a non-linear problem, then you get a linear divergence with time of some specific small deviations from the solution. But of course, this linear divergence does not exclude the possibility of having an exponential divergence for other well-chosen small deviations. So actually, you can think of various physical situations where you have this continuous family of periodic solutions. The Jellison effect is such an example. We know that when you couple weakly two condensates, then you get some oscillating currents between them. And the control parameter gamma could be simply the initial phase of the two condensates, the initial relative phase. So in this case, from this approach, you know that there will be a linear divergence with time, and physically the effect of this divergence is simply a collapse of the Josephson current, structure of time, this effect of quantum fluctuations on this current, as we have discussed in your talk. Okay, but I will turn now more specifically to the problems I'm interested in, which is the dynamics of an excited condensate in a harmonic trap. So typically in the experiments, the time sequence is the following. You start with the condensate in a stationary state, the temperature much smaller than Tc. Then you modulate the trap frequency for some time interval Te, and then later on you let the condensate freely oscillate in the unperturbed trap. So it turns out that in the Thomas Fermi regime, when the chemical potential is much larger than H bar omega, omega is the trap frequency, you can find approximate solutions to the Gross-Pitewski equation, which consists in a scaling transform plus a gauge transform. So I'm not going to discuss this in details. Those solutions have been found by Yuri Kagan and Juraj Chlebnikov, and also they are discussed in this paper. So here I've given the equation for the scaling parameter lambda, which determines the bracing of the condensate as time evolves. In fact, in the general anisotropic case, you need three scaling parameters to describe the evolution of the condensate. And of course, the existence of such a scaling solution is very interesting because we have an analytical solution of the GPE. And now we will be able to linearize around this specific solution. That's what I'm going to do now. So I have this specific self-scaling solution, and now I would like to linearize around this solution. So I have to solve a problem like that. IH bar divided by dt of UV is equal to LGP acting on UV. For example, U may be delta phi and V may be delta phi star. But in general, there is no connection between U and V. So in order to prepare for Thomas Fermi approximation, we first use this scaling and gauge transform, which maps phi U and V star onto phi tilde, U tilde and V tilde star. In this way, we absorb most of the evolution of phi. So this phi tilde is almost a constant after the rescaling. Then we perform the following change of variable. We introduce two quantities, alpha and beta. Alpha would be phi tilde star u tilde plus phi tilde v tilde. And you have beta is equal to u tilde over 2 phi tilde minus v tilde over 2 phi tilde star. So why do we choose this specific linear combination of u's and v's? Well, the idea is that now if you rewrite the equations for alpha and beta, and if you neglect the kinetic energy term, so the Laplacian in the Gross-Pitewski equation, then you get that alpha is a constant, IH bar divided by alpha is zero. So if I drop the kinetic energy term, I would get zero for the derivative of alpha, and for the derivative of beta, I get something proportional to mg times alpha divided by the product of the three scaling parameters. So now, of course, in general, you have to include the kinetic energy terms. For alpha, it's absolutely essential because zero is a bad approximation to anything. So we have to keep this term for alpha. But for beta, it's different because we have this ng factor, which is very large in the Thomas Fermi approximation. So for beta, I can neglect the kinetic energy term. And then the final approximations consist in replacing phi tilde by the stationary solution calculating the Thomas Fermi approximation. And then you get equations that are actually similar to the one used by Stringari in his hydrodynamic approach. Alpha is related to what you call delta rho, and the gradient of beta corresponds to delta V. Okay. But now we have this equation for alpha and beta. How can we solve it? In the general case of a totally anisotropic trap, we have not found analytical solutions. What we can do is to use a polynomial on that, and then numerically integrate this polynomial on that. In the isotropic traps, you can find analytical solutions for alpha and beta. You might find more details in this paper. But now I'm going to discuss in more detail the case of a cigar-shaped trap, which is typically the MIT case. So we are now in a regime where the trap frequency along Z is much smaller than the trap frequency along X and Y. And the idea is to try to find an effective 1D problem by eliminating the transverse degrees of freedom. So in the first step, we calculate the eigenfrequencies, so the frequency of the collective excitations of the system, as function of the ratio omega z to omega perp, restricting to modes with a zero angular momentum along the axis z. So here we have the square of the eigenmodes frequency in units of omega perp squared, as function of this ratio omega z over omega perp. And this calculation is done numerically using the polynomial on that, so in the time-independent case. And the nice feature is that you see that the various levels group into well-separated manifolds when omega z is much smaller than omega x, omega y. So when this ratio is very small, basically we can restrict the dynamics within those various manifolds, and we are going to concentrate on this manifold where the frequency of the mode is going to zero when omega z is going to zero. So we are going to restrict the dynamics inside this multiplicity. In this case, we simply find that alpha and beta are functions of z only. They do not depend on the radial coordinates. Furthermore, if you assume that the trap frequencies in the experiments are modulated slowly at frequencies on the order of omega z, so at frequencies much smaller than omega perp, then you can adiabatically eliminate the scaling parameters in the radial direction, and you are left really with a 1D situation. And it turns out that in this case, when you restrict to those purely axial modes, you can find solutions to the equations for alpha and beta. So we assume the following initial condition, that alpha and beta at m t equals 0 coincide with an axial eigenmode. So one of those modes discussed by Sandro Stringari. So we know that the eigenfrequencies are capital omega equal to 1 half times the trap frequency along z, times the square root of q times q plus 3. The q is an integer, positive integer. And now it turns out that the further evolution of this initial condition is very simple. Alpha is simply multiplied by some factor capital A, depending on t but not on z. And beta is multiplied by some complex factor b of t. Whatever you do with the trap frequency, provided of course that you restrict to a slow modulation of the trap frequencies. And A and B solve a very simple equation like that, with I A dot proportional to omega B over lambda Z squared, and B dot proportional to capital omega A the square root of lambda Z. So now, with those equations, we can analyze simply the typical experimental procedure used at MIT. So we imagine that the trap frequency along Z is modulated at the resonance frequency for the lambda Z parameter, which is the square root of 5 over 2 times omega Z. So this modulation takes place for 5 periods, and then you let the atoms oscillate in the unperturbed potential. Okay, so here I've plotted So here, yeah, imagine that the trough frequency along Z is modulated as 1 plus epsilon times a sine of this resonance frequency times T for 5 periods. And this epsilon is on the x-axis of this figure. And on the y-axis, I've plotted the energy at the end of the excitation phase, so the energy stored in the scaling parameter. So this energy is proportional to lambda z dot squared plus lambda z squared corresponding to the harmonic energy plus 1 over square root of lambda z corresponding to the interaction energy between the particles. So in this figure, you can see how much energy you deposit in the system as function of the modulation amplitude of the frequency epsilon. So if you take a typical value epsilon order of 0.1, you see you achieve an energy which is on the order of 4. Omega z squared. So now you can perform a stability analysis of the various axial modes. So here I have two coordinates for this figure. The first one is simply the eigenfrequency of the mode in units of the initial frequency along z. So this parameter takes only quantized value proportional to the square root of q times q plus 3. And the y-axis corresponds to the energy at the end of the excitation phase measured in units of omega z squared. And every time you have a point on this figure, you get an unstable evolution. And when there is no point, the evolution is stable. So you see you have various instability domains. Those domains are getting smaller and smaller when you increase capital omega. So this vertical line, capital omega is equal to omega z, corresponds to the center of mass motion of the condensate along z. And of course, this motion is stable. And indeed, you find that this line does not intersect this instability domain. This vertical line corresponds to the mode with the frequency square root of phi over 2 times omega z. This is the frequency for the period of the evolution of lambda z. And from the previous consideration obtained when you have a periodic solution of the GPE, you expect to get linear divergence with time. And you find indeed that this vertical line is just at the border of the instability domain, which corresponds to a marginal stability. And you have other modes that can become unstable. So in the next figure, I show the instability exponent, what I call the Lyapunov exponent for the various modes, as function of the energy of the excitation. Okay, so if you take typical value is equal to 4 for the energy, then you find that there are two modes, two instable modes, Q is equal to 3 and Q is equal to 4. And what is important in this figure is that really there is a threshold when the excitation energy is too small, there is no unstable mode. So we have to put enough energy in the system to get instabilities.
What is the chemical potential in terms of this energy?
Well, basically, if you calculate the total energy per particle, when you get 4 here, this means that it's on the order of a few mu. So experimentally, by tuning this modulation amplitude, you can choose this energy. For example, you can put it to a value close to 2. In this case, there should be a single unstable mode corresponding to Q equals 3. So we have analyzed the situation in more details. So I assume that there is a unique instable mode corresponding to Q equals 3. This mode is actually an odd function of Z. And we have to determine the effect of this instability on the various quantities in the problem. So first, what is the effect of this instability on phi, on the solution of the Gostkowski equation?
Q is
this integer labeling the axial modes. So QGL3 is a mode described by a polynomial of degree 3 in Z. So what is the impact on phi? You might fear that the self-scaling solution be no longer valid in presence of an instability. Actually, we have no simple and scale prediction. But at least if you limit to linear stability, linear analysis of the deviation of the evolution of the error due to the scaling approximation, you don't expect anything dramatic because this unstable mode is odd. So it doesn't couple to the condensed wave function phi, which is even. We have also performed a numerical integration of the Gross-Pitevsky equation for long times, and we have not seen any clear deviation of phi from the scaling solution. So our feeling is that the scaling approximation remains good, even by an instability. But now we can calculate the impact of this instability on the density of non-condensed particles. So actually the number of non-condensed particles is going to increase exponentially fast this time, and so will the density of non-condensed particles. So this density is proportional to u tilde squared plus v tilde squared, and proportional to the initial number of particles in the mode. So assuming the temperature larger than h bar capital omega over k, which is realistic experimentally, you find that this density measured in units of the condensed density means of phi 0 squared, phi 0 is a condensed wave function at the origin. So you find that the density scales as kt over h bar omega times mu over h bar omega, so those two factors are large, times the modulus of b of t squared. And this modulus of b of t is increasing exponentially fast with time, and you can easily reach values on the order of 100 for the modulus of b when you have an oscillation time on the order of, let's say, 40, when you have omega z times t is equal to 40. So actually, to see those instabilities, you should let the condensate oscillate long enough in the trap so that the instability has time to develop. So finally, what is the impact on the condensate density through the correction phi 2 to the Gross-Pitevsky equation? Well, actually, we find that this correction is on the same order as the density of non-condensed particles. So it's more or less the same effect.
What does mean non-condensed? What does mean non-condensed?
So this is the modification to the condensed density due to this phi 2, and we find that it is on the order of the density of non-condensed particles. By this I mean density of non-condensed particles, which is written above. Okay, so here I've plotted u squared plus v squared as function of z when I am along the axis of the trap, just to see the spatial dependence of the density of the non-condensed particles in this unstable mode. So Z is measured on units of the spatial extension of the condensate along Z. And you find typically striations like that. So if you are correct, by measuring the total density, you should see striations emerging when there is an instability. Okay, so in the last minutes, how long do you have? 15
minutes.
10 minutes, okay. Okay, so now we're going to discuss a different situation, which is the case of a two-component condensate. So our model is the following. We assume that we have atoms with two internal states, an internal state capital A and an internal state capital B. And to describe the interaction between those particles, we have to introduce coupling constants, GAA for the interaction between A and A, GBB for the interaction between B and B, and GAB for the interaction between A and B. Now we assume that those two internal states are trapped in harmonic potentials. We assume that those potentials have the same curvature, but they may be shifted spatially with respect to each other. And now we consider this Gila type experiment, already discussed by Carl Wieman during this workshop. So at time t is equal to 0 minus n particles are in the internal state A, and they are in a stationary state, we assume, so at a very low temperature. And abruptly, you transfer part of the particles from A to B. So at time t is equal to 0 plus, you have n A particles in A and n B particles in B. And the situation now is no longer stationary, because in general, the public constants, GAA, GBB, and GAB, are different. So if you want, you have performed an abrupt change in the public constants while transferring the atoms from A to B. So in the experiments, A was corresponding to F equal 1, M equal to minus 1, and B was corresponding to F equal 2, M is equal to plus 1. So we have tried to analyze the situation along the same lines of the previous analysis. And the key points of the previous analysis was the existence of a scaling solution to the Gross-Lutsky equation. So fortunately, it has been shown by Kagan and Shabikov that when you have a variation of the public constant between the particles, in the case of a condensate with a single internal state, you can still find a scaling solution. So here, we have two internal states. So it was not obvious that you could also, in this case, find a scaling solution. But it turns out that if you you can find numbers NA and NB, such that NA GAA plus NB GAB is equal to NB GBB plus NA GAB, then the condensate wave functions in A and B will remain initially proportional, and they will remain proportional forever. And then you can find, for these common wave functions in A, B, you can find a scaling solution. But you can check that in order to find such numbers of particles in B, then GAB should be outside of the interval GAA, GBB. Indeed, if GAB is in between GAA and GBB, then NA or NB has to be negative. So, in our treatment, in the analytical treatment, we have to restrict to GAB outside of this interval. And then we can use the scaling solution, as we did, and we perform exactly the same analysis. So, we have now a spinor which has components UA, UB, VA, VB. So the first step is to try to decouple the part of those components from the others. And it turns out that if you consider UA minus VA and UB minus VB, this decouples from UA plus VA, UB plus VB. So formally, you are left with a situation similar to the one of a single condensate. Then you apply the same analysis, we introduce the variables alpha and beta. When the trap is isotropic, you can even find analytical solutions to the corresponding equations for alpha and beta. And here is the result of the analysis. So along this axis, GAB, two important values are GBB and GAA. So when GAB is inside this interval, from this treatment, we cannot predict anything because there is no exact scaling solution. When GAB is larger than GAA, we find that the solution is unstable. And actually, we find that half of the modes in the Thomas Fermi approximation are unstable. It's not simply a few modes, but half of them are unstable. And in the opposite case, where GAB is smaller than GBB, we find that the dynamics is stable. So in the unstable case, this means that any small imperfection in the experiments will lead to a big deviation. That's a classical noise effect on an unstable solution. But it means also that the quantum fluctuations will lead to a non-trivial evolution of the two condensates. So in the scaling solution, the two condensates in A and B exactly overlap. But physically, very soon, because of quantum or classical noise, there will be a separation between them because of the instability. And you could form, for example, bubbles. So we are trying now to analyze the dynamics. But meanwhile, so we have learned from Carl Wieman that the experimental case is exactly inside this interval. the ratio of GAA to GBB is equal to 1.06, and the ratio of GAB to GBB is equal to 1.03. So GAB is inside, is in between GAA and GBB. So what we have done simply is to perform a numerical integration of the gross viscosity equation to see what happens in this case. So as in the experiment, we assume that initially half of the particles are in A and half of the particles are in B. And we integrate the gross viscosity equation with 5, 10 to the 6 particles. We have shifted the two isotropic traps by a small amount, on the order of 3% of the size of the condensate. And the trap frequency is actually 2 pi times 200 Hz. So those calculations are very preliminary. They have been performed yesterday. Well, the recent experimental results at the ANS obtained. So I'm trying to play the same game with the theory. So here you see the integrated densities of particles for the species A and B as function of Z. So this is initial distribution, the two packets exactly coincide. There is same spatial dependence and the same number of particles. At the time t is equal to 3 over omega, you see already a separation, a spatial separation between the two. So the separation proceeds. And for the moment, we cannot consider long interaction times because we get problems with the grid. Our grid is not large enough in momentum space. We can also plot isosurfaces for the spatial densities for the species A and B, so as function of time. So at time t equals 0, the isosurfaces are simply spheres, as our trap is isotropic. And when time proceeds, you see that there's a separation between A and B. So A is shifted towards the bottom, and B is shifted towards the top. And you get the isosurfaces looking like medusas. Okay, but those results are simply preliminary, and we will try to make more detailed analysis. So I will conclude now. So in the first part of the talk, I mentioned this U1 symmetric preserving bubble bop approach, which has the advantage of predicting a systematic, in a systematic way, the first correction to the gross viscosity equation. And the conclusion is that, in principle, the anomalous average should be kept in the theoretical treatments. We have found that basically there are two possible situations. In the first case, the solution of the time-dependent gross viscosity equation is a stable solution. So any small deviation from phi grows at least, at most, polynomially with time. In this case, you will see in the experiment a deviation from the GP prediction after time scaling as n to the alpha, where n is the number of particles and alpha is of some exponent, typically 1/2. Here, I assume that ng, again, is a constant while n is getting very large. In the second situation, phi is an unstable solution, and then you can get deviations for after a short time, scaling as a logarithm of the number of particles. So even in the condensate with a huge number of particles, you could see a deviation from the GPE after a short time. So I've analyzed briefly experimental situations where you have an unstable motion of the condensate. And the first situation was an MIT type experiment where the condensate was excited then was oscillating the unperturbed trap. The prediction is that if you excite sufficiently the system, you should see striations on the density. Actually, at MIT, they observed this type of striations, but we have not performed yet a detailed comparison. So we don't know if those striations are really due to the instability. And of course, there remains a question. When does this instability saturate? It was, of course, this exponential growth of the number of non-condensed particles cannot last forever. It will saturate at a stage. And we don't have any answer to this question within the perturbative treatment we are using. Thank you for your attention.
Discussion questions to Yuri, please. Could you please stand up so that everyone sees you, including the whole? Thank you.
I would like to ask you one serious question. There is instability which is connected with this principle thing, or instability which is connected with the fact that we are using Thomas' theorem of estimation. I mean the following. For example, in two-dimensional case, you know, we have exact solution without Thomas' theorem approximation for a large change of frequency in a time situation. Yes? Nevertheless, we have absolutely exact solution without Thomas' theorem approximation. But if we take, nevertheless, Thomas' theorem approximation from the beginning, for this two-dimensional case, we could face instability because we take from the beginning not correct approximation, not correct solution. So my question is, what is connected with Thomas' theorem approximation at the beginning, not correct selection of zero point, of zero approximation? approximation, or what is principle?
Okay, thank you for this question. So you're afraid that the Thomas' theorem approximation could introduce spurious divergences. So 2 points. First, you are right. In 2D, the scaling transform is exact when you have an isotropic trap, and when you use the approach we have used for in the Thomas' theorem limit, you find indeed that the A's and B's remain stable. So you don't get instabilities. Yes, if you want, you will get similar equations for capital A and capital B for the evolution of alpha and beta, as we did in the cigar-shaped trap. But the difference will be that now in 2D, in the isotropic case, those two factors will be exactly the same. You will get in both equations 1 over lambda squared. This means that if you simply redefine the time, then you will get, with a new time tau, you will get simple equation that I A dot is equal to omega B, and I B dot is equal to omega A. So there is no instability in this case. So that's the first test. The second test is to perform a full numerical treatment of the problem, and to see if you have instabilities or not. So the idea is to simply integrate the equation for phi numerically, and then integrate the equation for your U's and V's numerically, and see what happens. We have done that in the isotropic case, and we have compared to the Thomas' Fermi prediction. And what we find is that there is an agreement. So there is also a threshold for the instability, the numerical calculation. And actually, to achieve optimal agreement, you should use this stability map in the isotropic case. And rather than using the frequency of the modes calculated in the Thomas' Fermi approximation, you should consider the exact frequencies. And then you get much better agreement with numerical calculation. So that's all. So our feeling that...
In the dimensional case, this plot, what it would give you if you would calculate two-dimensional case? What you obtain?
You mean numerically? There would be, as I said, no instability. Because, okay, this was the first point. So turning back to 2D. So again, in 2D, this is your question, right? In 2D, isotropic case, you get similar equations, but the factors are the same, the two equations. You get 1 over lambda z squared, 1 over lambda squared in the first one, and also 1 over lambda squared in the second. That would be exactly the same. So you can cancel this time-dependent factor by a redefinition of time. So the evolution is trivial. What you find is that all the modes simply oscillate at the frequency omega, whatever you do with the trap frequencies.
Other questions? Yes, hello, please.
Yes. How many oscillations? Okay, so what I can do is, in this case, calculate a Lyapunov exponent. That's all I can do, more or less, in this treatment. So your question is, yes. Ah no, in this case, there is no instability. So. Yes, so in this case, you find that A's and B's simply go to a constant value, because the scaling parameter lambda is going to zero very fast when time is going to infinity. So in the equations for capital A and capital B, you find A dot is equal to zero and B dot is equal to zero. So there is no evolution of the number of non-condensed particles, no growth. Yes, exactly. The system should realize. Yes, so what you can calculate is the Lyapunov exponent, and you find, so you can estimate the growth of the solution after one period. And the Lyapunov exponent is typically on the order of 0.1 omega. So the increase would be after one period exponential of 0.1 omega times 2 pi of omega. Which is exponential of 0.6, more or less. This gives you the idea of the evolution after one period.
Martin?
Do you think on the one hand, the solve for
Well, if you want, my philosophy is the following. I'm not able to do the calculation with the exact potential, so I take a model potential. It's a model, if you want. So I take as a model potential, the absolute potential, and then I try to solve the problem within this model. You can tell me that this model is not realistic because I have not taken the exact experimental potential. I have not taken into account free body effects, but that's the best I can do. Yeah.
Okay, Tony?
I have a question about two different kinds of depletion of the condensate. If I take the simplest possible case, which is just a translation invariant case, then even at zero temperature, I have some depletion of the condensate because I'm forming coherent pairs of K minus K. And then at finite temperature, even if I'm in thermal equilibrium, I have an extra depletion because I've got real probably more present what was formed.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, even in a time-dependent situation, you can still make this distinction between, as it were, depletion which happens because I've excited things coherently in pairs out of the condensate, and the residual depletion, which is, if you like, real probably of quasar particles. I wasn't clear if that comes out explicitly in your formal approach or not, or so how it comes out.
What comes in our approach is simply, you have to give initial state for the system. So, depending on the fact you are at zero temperature or at the finite temperature, the initial number of non-condensed particles will change. But there is no distinction. So, the initial temperature simply fixes the initial conditions for the occupation numbers of the non-condensate modes.
But then, presumably, will be changes thereafter. And presumably, they could be due to either of these two effects. And I was just wondering whether that comes out explicitly in your formalism or not.
Well, I don't see exactly what you mean. So in our approach, the evolution of the non-condensed particles is linear. So we don't include collision effects between the particles. So what do you feel exactly? If the temperature is too high, you have many particles out of the condensate, so you have to include collisions, maybe? Is that
maybe this is
technical
enough
we should discuss. How are collisions included? Are you saying there isn't a lot of students? I'm here, this was related to a possible organization.
No, no, I don't think so, because again, the dynamics for the non-condensed particles is linear. Those non-condensed particles, if you want, simply move in some potential, but they don't interact with each other. So, we cannot predict thermalization in this, this approach, I don't think so.
I mean, isn't the point that you calculated your L to order the scattering length, you included terms in your L of order scattering length squared, mm-hmm. then you would presumably get collisions out of the, I mean, you would then have your K terms, and those terms are exponential and would presumably be the dominant terms that one would think of as giving rise to the depletion associated with the new, with the fact that in the new wider potential, there are lots, you're going to end up with a lot of non-conventional particles, but you let that out by only calculating L to order A rather than order A square.
Yes, you're right. Of course, if you go to an arbitrary order, then
right.
it's exact, but as we stop at the first order for the lambdas, we don't have those terms, so.
There, you must come out of the Bagalin
process. Right.
So you will have to go a few steps further.
But
yeah.
those mm-hmm. are dominant terms.
Yes, they will become dominant. As you populate those known condensed cloud, you start getting collisions. Yeah, I agree, of course, yes. But I said from the start that I cannot describe easily this effect.
Can I ask another naive question? I mean, in some sense, you would think that there is a classical limit whereby if we just have in a single harmonic oscillator problem, one has a packet, one can have what amounts to the ground state wave packet going back and forth in an excited state, and that's the classical limit of the harmonic oscillator. The question could you have that kind of state breathing and going backward and forward in your potential if you neglect this
So you're mentioning now a motion for the center of mass of the cloud,
you have what amounts your initial wave packet. You might think of as a wave packet for a classical particle in an excited state, which should move back and forth in your new potential, and because it corresponds, so to speak, to a high energy. Or there is a wave packet that corresponds to a high energy in your new potential, your flat.
Yes, okay, so you expand the
initial. There is a classical solution that corresponds to a particle, to the condensate just going back and forth in that new potential. Can you construct a wave packet that has that property?
So your idea would be
initial condensate that has that property, but back and forth in your new omega.
You mean the idea would be to shift initially the condensate so that it would oscillate in the new trap?
Yeah,
if we simply open the trap like that, you get a symmetric bracing
of
the condensate.
Well, we know there exists a state in the classical limit that just is a little wave packet.